Everybody ready? We left off in Proverbs 26, beginning with verse 1. It says, like snow in summer and like rain in harvest, so honor is not fitting for a fool. Obviously, what Solomon is saying here is that some things just don't go together. That's all there is to it. I mean, you don't normally see snow in the summertime, do you? I mean, it's not very often. Just not the natural order of things to see snow in the summer and the rain in the harvest period. And so he says, so honor is not fitting for a fool. But you know what? When I read that, I mean, I can't help but say, you know what? He's right in terms of if a person's a fool, he doesn't deserve honor. And yet, at the same token, isn't it bizarre? To me, interesting that we see, in my opinion, there are so many fools today that are being given honor, who are nothing but God haters. They're given honor, these people who promote so many things that are an offense to God. So when you read something like this, Solomon is saying, it's just out of place. But here's the thing. My question would always be, hey, in the end, are we going to be honored before God? Because it says in Samuel, David wrote, I believe, he said something to the effect that, God just basically said that those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me, I will lightly esteem. And so it boils down to, it's one thing to be honored by men, but it's a totally different thing to be honored by God. And a lot of people who are honored by men are not going to be honored by God in the end. In verse 2 it says, like a sparrow in its flitting and like a swallow in its flying, so a curse without cause does not alight. And basically what Solomon is saying is if a person throws out a curse against somebody, if the curse is without cause or justification, it has no more effect upon a person than a bird flying over their head. That's what he's basically trying to tell us. And people weren't supposed to curse anybody. But here's the thing, too. If you read the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 28 especially, you will see that God pronounces all kinds of curses upon people that are going to come upon people if they forsake him, if they turn against him, if they disobey him. You know, he lists a number of curses that would come upon him. And as a matter of fact, if you go through and read that chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, I can't help but see so much of it coming to pass right now. And I just see that we are cursed everywhere because we've forsaken God. But here it's talking about here somebody throws out a curse. Obviously, God doesn't want us to curse anybody. I mean, this is something that you get into as far as witchcraft, casting spells and this type of thing. But still, if a person is not going to bring a curse on their head, you know, a divine curse on their head if they are obeying God and living for God. In verse 3 it says, a whip is for a horse. It's for the horse and a bridle for the donkey and a rod for the back of fools. What is a fool? I mean, Solomon says so many, many things about fools. I mean, in terms of making all the wrong decisions, doing all the stupid, idiotic, foolish things. And sometimes fools are just stubborn in their ways. They're just set in their ways. And you can't, the only thing that it's going to turn them around is, you know, like you said, a whip is for a horse, a bridle is for a donkey. And you can't just instruct a fool because he's not going to take instruction. You have to force a fool to do what's right. And verse 4 says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. Do you guys ever remember any time in Jesus' life when this kind of transpired? It makes me think of what happened in Matthew 21. He says, when he, Christ, entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders and the people came to him while he was teaching, and he said, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? In other words, they asked him, by whose authority did Jesus Christ, you know, throw over the money changers' tables and throw them out of the temple? And they want to know, who gave you this authority to do this? And this is what Jesus said to him. And Jesus said, I will also ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, what source was it, from heaven or from men? And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say to us, then why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the people, for they all regard John as a prophet. And answering Jesus, they said, we do not know. He also said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. And, I can't help but think of that episode when we read this. Look at this in verse 4 and 5 together. It says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. Isn't that exactly what Jesus did there? I mean, to me, it just epitomizes what Jesus did. I mean, these people were fools. They were always looking for an occasion to get in Jesus' face, to just oppose him. They weren't interested in what he had to say. They were so hell-bent on just destroying him and just undermining everything that he stood for. And so when they asked him a question, it wasn't, you know, Jesus wasn't going to give them the time of day. He says, okay, I'll tell you by what authority I do these things, but first you ask me a question. Whose authority did John have? Was it from God or was it from men? And they knew the answer. They just didn't want to put themselves in that position. So Jesus didn't even answer them. He said, well, I'm not going to answer you either. And then he says in verse 6, he says, he cuts off his own feet and drinks violence. Who sends a message by the hand of a fool? What does that mean, in essence? Well, in essence, what it's saying is, hey, man, if you have something that really is important that needs to be done, you know, there's certain people that you just cannot trust. You cannot depend upon them regardless of what they say to you. And they're really foolish if you give them an important task to do and everything's dependent upon them when they have a history that just shows that, hey, man, they are undependable. And in verse 7, it says, like their legs, which are useless to the lame, so is a proverb in the mouth of fools. I like this proverb. I like it a lot because it says, like legs, which are useless to the lame. So is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Obviously, the lame person, what good are his legs? I mean, he can't stand on them. Well, same thing with a proverb in the mouth of a fool. A proverb in the mouth of a fool means nothing. He can't stand on this proverb because he doesn't live it out. And you can apply it to a number of things, especially spiritual things. Let's just say a person is really, really dishonest. And then he throws out some kind of proverb about honesty. I mean, what good is that? I mean, he doesn't have a leg to stand on, so the proverb becomes useless. In verse 8, he says, like one who binds a stone in a sling, so is he who gives honor to a fool. What's that saying? In essence, what's it saying?
Well, a sling is for casting the stone, so if you bind it in there, defeats the purpose.
It's going to come back and hit you right in the head. You know what I'm saying? If you had even like just a slingshot and you put the rock in there, but it was bound in there, and then you shot it, it's going to go straight out and straight back and hit you right between the eyes. I mean, it's just going to boomerang on you. That's what he's talking about there. Like one who binds a stone in a sling, so is he who gives honor to a fool. And like I said, look at all the fools, in my opinion, that are being given honor today. But in the end, this is going to come back to haunt them. And to me, if you elect a man to office, you have honored him in that respect. And if this man does not honor God, then this is going to come back and hit you right between the eyes. I mean, you can broaden that application to encompass a number of different things. In verse 9, it says, like a thorn which falls into the hand of a drunkard, so is a proverb in the mouth of fools. That's saying, you know, pretty much what it says up there in that verse 7. Like the legs which are useless to the lame, so is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Look at that verse 9. Like a thorn which falls into the hand of a drunkard, so is a proverb in the mouth of fools. I mean, God's just reiterating himself for emphasis here. If a person is just falling down drunk, he's so intoxicated and so inebriated that he falls down and he lands on a thorn bush, what's his going to be his response?
He's not
even going to feel it. You know what I'm saying? Like a thorn which falls into the hand of a drunkard, so is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. It's going to have no effect. No effect upon him. A proverb in the mouth of a fool is going to have no effect if he, you know, quotes a proverb, because he's not living it. It means nothing. This is why people were so, I think, taken back by Christ, is because they were constantly saying, man, this guy, he speaks with authority. He speaks with authority. He's not like the scribes and the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Well, in order to speak with authority, I really do believe you have to be living it. If you're not living it, then you have no moral grounds to speak, and you're not going to be speaking with authority. I mean, I don't know how many times I've said it over the years, that two people could say the exact same thing. And one of them, you detect life, and another one, you don't feel anything. One of them, it's the spirit that comes out of the person. But if a person isn't living in obedience to God, then they're not speaking with authority. And in verse 10, it says, like an archer who wounds everyone, so is he who hires a fool or who hires those who pass by. Look at all the times that Solomon talks about fools. I mean, just over and over and over again. He says, like an archer who wounds everybody. I mean, this guy is a bad shot, isn't he? I mean, if he's aiming at a target and everybody's got to duck for cover, he's saying, so is he who hires a fool or hires those who pass by. If you hire those who pass by, they're strangers. You don't even know them. You don't know what they're like. I just ran into a guy yesterday walking in his door, and he's just saying, you know, anybody who wants to hire somebody to work cheap. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, even if I had money to hire you, and even if I had stuff to do, I don't think I would, you know, because I don't know you. You know, I didn't say that to him, but I even think I would be very foolish to do that, even though I would certainly like to help anyone down on their luck. But, man, especially nowadays, you just don't know what you're going to be dealing with. And in verse 11 says, like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. You know, Peter says almost the exact same thing. Matter of fact, Peter does say the same thing. He quotes it in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 22. Like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. I look at our prisons today. You've heard the old saying that our prisons are nothing but revolving doors. What does that mean?
In and out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They release him and they're back in the next week, the next day, the next month, the next year for doing the same thing. I mean, read this. Like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. You would think that a wise person, if he did something very, very stupid and very, very foolish and he ended up in jail, ended up in prison, well, the wise person would say, man, I am never, ever, ever, ever going to do such a stupid, idiotic, foolish thing again. I am never coming back to this place, right? That would be the wise person, right? But look at how many fools go back to prison over and over and over and over again. It's like a dog returning to his vomit. Our prisons have very often become revolving doors. And people could say, well, you know, it's because our whole prison system is broken down. It's because this, that, and the other thing. I said, no. If a person goes to prison and becomes a wise person, he's not coming back. You see, that's why I really do believe that one of the best success rates that you can have with prisoners, and I've been in and out of prisons, in and out of jails, in and out of juvie, you know, trying to help people, pray with people, read the Bible, to witness to them and whatnot. And I think the greatest success rate going is if you can turn a person's heart to God. And really seriously, they turn their life to God, then all of a sudden they're going to get some wisdom in their life and they're not going to repeat their folly. All these other things that they jump through, all these hoops, all these programs, all I think that they've been shown over and over and over again is to be useless. Because what you're dealing with here is not a broken system. What you're dealing with here is a fool who needs a changed heart. And verse 12 says, do you see a man who's wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Look how many times Solomon is talking about fools. I mean, do you see a man who's wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Well, a man who's wise in his own eyes means what?
He's got the answers.
Yeah. You can't tell him anything. You know, he won't listen. He knows it all. I like that bumper sticker that once said, hire a teenager while he still knows everything. Because sometimes, you know, when you're young and you're dumb, you think you know it all. Well, it says here, do you see a man who's wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. I mean, it's a wise person who will seek counsel, a wise person who will seek advice, a wise person will pray about things. A fool, he won't be bothered whether he thinks he knows it all. Verse 13 says, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the road. A lion is in the open square. As the door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in a dish. He is weary of bringing it to his mouth again. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can give a discreet answer. Now look at that. How many times have we dealt with the sluggard? In Proverbs, God has spoken about the sluggard over a dozen times so far. And look what he's saying. I mean, this verse 13, 14, 15, and 16, he's talking about the sluggard. As a matter of fact, this verse 13, he virtually repeats himself verbatim when we went through chapter 22, verse 13. Says basically the same thing. The sluggard says, there's a lion out in the road. The lion is an open square. Well, what does that mean? What is he really?
For an excuse.
Yeah.
To do anything.
Yeah. He said, well, it's dangerous out there. I can't get up and go to work. It's raining out. I might get in a car wreck. Or, you know, I can't get up and go to work because I might get struck by lightning. I mean, just throw it out there. I mean, it's just some phony excuse of why you can't go out, get out of bed, get off the TV, and go out there and work for a living. You know, so they come up with one excuse after another after another. And even maybe if there is an element, let's just say, of danger or something, it's grossly exaggerated. Because this is what the sluggard wants to do. He doesn't want to work for a living. He doesn't want to go out there and roll up his sleeves. You know, so he will come up with any lame excuse after another after another. He says in that verse 14, as the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. You know, he's just lazy. He's just slothful. And he says verse 15.
John, on 14, I was thinking that, you know, here's the door opening and closing. The door is opening to let people go through and are doing things, and it's allowing activity, but the door itself just isn't going anywhere.
He's just going to stay on his bed while everything else is going on around him, you know. And he says in verse 15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is wearying of bringing it to his mouth again. Now, we've had something very similar to this in, I think it was Proverbs 19:24. I have never seen somebody so lazy that they don't eat. A lazy person, very often, that's all they do is eat. Okay, that's their favorite activity. Sit in front of the TV and eat. Munch on bonbons, eat popcorn, or, you know, potato chips, drink beer, whatever. But I think what he's suggesting here, the sluggard buries his hand in his dish, he's wearying of bringing it to his mouth again. The suggestion to me is this. The sluggard a lot of times will go out and do what he wants to do. Okay, he'll find the time, the money, the energy, the effort to do what he wants to do. Let's just say a sluggard might like to fish, or he might like to hunt. Well, if he hunts down a prey, shoots some pheasants, or let's say catch some fish, he's too lazy to clean it. He's too lazy to clean it, all right? He just enjoyed the sport of it, but now he's too lazy to what? To gut the fish and to scale it back and to clean it and put it in the refrigerator or to cook it or anything like that. He enjoys the sport, but if there's going to be the slightest bit of work involved, well, forget it. In verse 16, he says, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can give a discreet answer. And you know what that's saying? What is that saying? Well, I deal with some lazy people, and I know this. There's certain people I feel like I can motivate a little bit, trying to get them moving, trying to get them going. Other people that are lazy, I don't say a thing to, because I know these type of people will just take offense, and they just feel like, you know, they have all the answers, and if you were to even remotely suggest that, hey man, you're really being a sluggard here. I mean, it would just be red faced with indignation and just be really hostile in your face, because they feel like, hey, you're wrong. I'm not lazy. Because to admit you're lazy, that takes a great deal of humility, doesn't it? I have yet to see a real lazy person come out and say, you know what my problem is? I'm lazy. Because the lazy person just come up with excuses as to why he doesn't work hard or why he doesn't work. Just look at how this perpetuates itself. In my opinion, a sluggard is a person who doesn't apply themselves in school, right? I mean, that's just a flat-out truth. They are too lazy to open a book, to study, to really apply themselves, to diligently do the assignments, do their homework, diligently get to class, get there on time, participate, and just really put out in their classes and then end up graduating. A sluggard, what will he do? He will skip class, he will come in late, he won't do his assignment, he will be shiftless, he will be lazy, and then he'll drop out of school. Now, his problem is he's lazy. Sure, it is a real flaw in his character, but now, where's his future going to go? I can guarantee you, his future is that he is going to be a lazy sluggard who's going to be in and out of prison because he's not working for a living, and he's just going to be sucking off society. And where did that laziness start? It started way back in grade school. You know what I'm saying? I mean, people are not born slothful, lazy. This is what happens to them. And, you know, a lot of times I think the parents are to blame, because they really need to, you know, make sure their kids do the assignments and get over there and do what they're told and obey the teachers and be cooperative and all these things. But, you know, like I say, then when you got a second generation coming up with sluggers, what are you going to have now? You're not going to have a bunch of diligent people, that's for sure, because you reap what you sow. Verse 17, he says, like one who takes a dog by the ears is one who passes by and meddles with strife not belonging to him. In other words, what it's saying, I think, in essence, is, hey, man, it's really, really foolish to get involved in an argument that's none of your business, right? I mean, that's what he's saying here. Like one who takes a dog by the ears. I mean, if you go up and yank a dog's ear, what is the dog's natural response going to be? He's going to turn and bite your hand. I mean, he just is, right? And so if you get into an argument that's absolutely none of your business, I mean, you're going to get your head taken off. So he's saying, hey, man, get away from that. And I'll tell you what, right now, I got two brothers that are cops, and the call they hate the most is domestic disputes. Why? Anybody tell me?
Getting in the middle of two fighting people, and that's
and it's become the most violent place outside of our war zone. It just is, and these cops, they don't want to get involved with that, but they, you know, that's their job. They're not meddlers, but a lot of times they get in between two people who are just trying, you know, want to kill each other. And look out in verse 18, it says, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, was I not joking? Now what does that mean? The extreme example would be somebody yelling fire in a crowded theater. Let me read that again. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, was I not joking? There could be times when you could, you know, yell fire in a crowded theater and cause some real damage, if not death, simply because people might be stampeding over each other, right? But there's a lot of other ways. I remember, you know, being young and dumb. I remember I was like about 12 years old. And had a friend who I was giving a lift on my bicycle. You know, he was sitting up on a handlebars, and I'm just pedaling away down the road. And I don't know what got into me, but I thought, oh, this is going to be cool. This guy won't even know it. He's sitting there up on the handlebars looking straight ahead of him, and I just shoved the bike and just jumped off. And he's going down the road. You know, the bike's rolling down the road. He doesn't know that I'm not on the bike. And next thing you know is the bike's slowing down and he's turning around. And of course, he has a horrendous crash. And I'm just laughing. And I'm laughing so hard there's tears coming down my eyes because it looks so funny. But, you know, you look back on that, it was this. It was, the guy was mad, but I couldn't help laughing. It just looked so funny to me. But the guy could have got hurt seriously, right? Well, that's what it's saying here. It says, was it not a joke? Well, I could have really hurt somebody there. And in verse 20 says, for lack of wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no whisperer, contention quiets down. Well, you know, that's pretty self-explanatory, but when people are gossiping and slandering, if we don't partake of that, then we diffuse it. In other words, if we get involved in it, then all we're doing is adding fuel to the fire. And Solomon does say that where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. So if we get into a situation where we just continue to talk about other people, the contention is going to keep going on, going and going. But I think a godly thing, the Christ-like thing to do is just, hey, diffuse the whole thing by not even getting involved in it. In verse 21, it says, like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. A contentious man is a quarrelsome man, an argumentative man, and he's just going to add fuel to the fire every time. That's all there is to it, because that seems to be his character. And the best thing to do is stay away from such a person, because, you know, you're just going to get burned by such a person. And there are a lot of those people running around today. And you especially see it in gangs. You especially see it, don't you? Look at this. Read it again. Like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. Look at all the bloodshed that goes on between one gang against another gang. I mean, these guys are killing each other left and right, for the most asinine, stupid, shallow, idiotic reasons. And in verse 22, it says, the words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels, and they go down into the innermost parts of the body. Now, what does that mean?
Gossip.
Yeah, well, you know, there's something about gossip that we just have a natural tendency to relish, I guess. I mean, I think that if you look at all these gossip magazines, they're the biggest selling magazines or the newspapers in the country, because they just have that appeal to them, right? And I don't know what it is. I guess what it is when you're talking about somebody else's faults and failures and shortcomings and everything else, maybe it makes you look good. I don't know. Makes you feel good about yourself or whatever. Verse 23, it says, like an earthen vessel overlaid with silver dross are burning lips in a wicked heart. Now, what does that mean? If you've got an earthen vessel, it's not worth much. It's just a clay pot, right? Clay jar, right? And then if it's overlaid with silver dross, it's not overlaid with silver, it's overlaid with all the dross or the impurities that come off of melted silver, right? So it's just worthless. So you've got a worthless dross on a worthless clay pot, and he says, our burning lips and a wicked heart. That's what he's saying. In other words, you've got a person with a wicked heart. I mean, what's going to come out of them, what's going to come through their lips, is just going to be totally worthless. That's what he's saying. And in verse 24, it says, he who hates disguises it with his lips, but he lays up deceit in his heart. When he speaks graciously, Do not believe him, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred covers itself with guile, his wickedness will be revealed before the assembly. You know, there's an awful lot you can apply to that, but who does that remind you of? Anyone in particular? Throw Judas in here. Let's read it again, verses 24 through 26. It says, he who hates disguises it with his lips, but he lays up the seed in his heart. When he speaks graciously, do not believe him, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred covers itself with guile, his wickedness will be revealed before the assembly. Isn't that exactly what happened to Judas? Exactly. He just had a root of bitterness that basically was just festering for years and years, and then he turns on Christ. But how did he betray Christ?
With a kiss.
With a kiss, right? He's gone down in infamy for betraying Jesus with a kiss. And I think there are a lot of people like that. In a sense, they're just treacherous. They're traitorous. You know, you can't trust them. And you know what I also see in this? You can apply it to the devil himself. Go all the way back to the first fall and you can see it. And you can see, you know, his offspring all over the place today. And Judas was a prime example of it. Verse 27, he who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. What does that remind you of in the Old Testament? Who did this happen to? Anybody remember?
Joseph. Dug a pit for him.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, he who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone. Well, yeah, you could...
It was probably a pit that was already there. Probably.
Yeah, well, what they did is they threw him into a pit, but what I'm saying is this. They dug a pit for him in this respect. They tried to bury him. They tried to sell him into Egypt, and then it all came back on him when he became the prime minister of Egypt. But when I read this, I was thinking more in the terms of Haman and Mordecai. Haman, remember in the book of Esther? Haman just hated Mordecai. He just hated him, and he finally had a gallows that was built with a 75 feet high. He ended up being hung on it instead of Mordecai, him and his sons, because he did this to bring this godly man down, and it came back, you know, really bite to him. And in verse 28 it says,
John mentioned Daniel in the pit.
Oh, good. That's another good one. That's a real good one. Yeah. Didn't even think of that. That's probably a better example. Daniel was thrown into a lion's pit, and by the very people who just had him thrown in there because they resented him. They were jealous of him. They were envious of him. And they tried to devise a way in which to get rid of him. And it just came back to really bite them because Daniel was delivered out of the pit and they were thrown into it, them and all their children. And their lions devoured them and their children before they even hit the ground.
Came back to bite them?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a much better example right there. And I thought you were asleep over there, Shum. Nice going. Okay, 28 says, a lion tongue hates those it crushes, and flattering mouth works ruin. How many times did you talk about the tongue? Like I said, if we started from chapter 10 in terms of Proverbs, then we've gone through, you know, 16 different chapters so far, and God has mentioned the tongue well over 100 times, probably around 120 times by now, as far as the tongue, the mouth, the lips. Look at this, a lying tongue hates those it crushes, and a flattering mouth works ruin. A flattering mouth. That says a lot. What is flattery?
Empty praise.
Yeah. Remember, when was Jesus flattered? Anybody remember? I remember that situation in Matthew 22 where it says, then the Pharisees went and plotted together on how they might trap him in what he said. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, now listen to what they say. Listen how they flatter Jesus. They said, teacher, we know that you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, and you are not partial to any. See, this is just flattery. All right? They're telling the truth, but it's just flattery. They're just meant to just try to hit him from a blind side. He says, tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give poll tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their malice. See? That was just flattery, right? And he said, why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me a coin used for the poll tax. And they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. And then he said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And hearing this, they were amazed, and leaving him, they went away. Now, just look at this, verse 28 again. A lying tongue hates those it crushes, and a flattering mouth works ruin. Well, they really tried to work ruin on Christ, right? But he just turned the tables on them. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that chapter 26? All right, let's just quickly go through this chapter 27. I think we've got time, because some of these problems you just read together. Beginning 1 of verse chapter 27 says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." And remember, I think it was James who said basically the same thing. He said this in James chapter 4. He said, he says, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that.' But as it is, you're boasting in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." When you read this proverb, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what the day may bring forth. In other words, if we're living for Christ, then how many times have I said, I live by the Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart, don't rely upon your own understanding, in all your ways acknowledge Him and He will direct your path. We can make all these plans and then be really boastful about it, but we don't know what it's going to bring forth. In verse 2 it says, "Let another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips." Now that's pretty straightforward. It's pretty, I think, understandable and self-explanatory, but it says a lot. I used to play racquetball with a guy who was a very, very, very good player, but all he would ever do is just boast about himself, and he'd make all kinds of good shots, but it got to the point where you didn't even bother complimenting him, because he's going to tell you how great he was. You know what I'm saying? And after a while, it just got to be just grating. It was like, this type of person, a lot of times what I see is they almost have an obsession to elevate themselves, put another person down in order to elevate themselves. It's not a bantering type of fun that men usually engage in when they like each other. They put each other down. No, this is a type of situation where you are serious and you're putting down of other people so that you can make yourself look good. And in verse 3 it says, "A stone is heavy and sand waiting, but the provocation of a fool is heavier than both of them." What's provocation?
Poking of a stick to try to rile somebody up.
Yeah, when you provoke somebody. It says a stone is heavy and the sand is weighty, but the provocation of a fool is heavier than both. We're going through this. I remember I shared one time when I was in high school. I took my sister to a show and her friend, and that was the night I just really, really just wanted to be by myself, all alone, didn't want to be bothered by anybody. And this fool comes up and just provoked me to no end for no good reason. And then all of his buddies provoked me. And then I just got in this horrendous fight, got arrested. I'm sitting back in the cop car. My sister's outside crying. And I'm just sitting there thinking, now how did this happen? All I wanted to do was just be all by myself, you know. And this fool provoked me, and now look what I'm being booked for, disturbing the peace. It can happen, you know. Verse 4 says, "Wrath is fierce and anger is a flood, but who can stand before jealousy?" That says a lot, because wrath and anger. Wrath is fierce and anger is a flood. Well, wrath and anger, these are explosive things that happen, okay? Wrath and anger, these are explosive. These are reactionary, right? Most of the time. But what makes jealousy so dangerous?
You want to get back at somebody and you put some thought into it.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, when you're angry, it could be a reaction, right? Where it's not premeditated. Jealousy, a lot of times, the things that you can do to another person out of jealousy is really, really thought out. It's just kind of a constant type of malice or ill will towards somebody. Who can stand before that? Look at the Son of God couldn't even stand before it. All right? Even Pilate saw that the people who gave him up, you know, to be crucified, it was purely out of envy, purely out of jealousy. Who can stand before that? Anger is one thing, wrath is another thing, but man, if jealousy is involved, then you're finished, you're through, it's over, it's done. And verse 5, it says, "Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed." What's that mean? Well, I think you could apply it a different ways, but apply it to children, because I think this says a lot. Solomon talks about, hey man, if you don't use the rod on your kid, it shows you hate him, right? So when it says better is open rebuke, I look at some of the kids that, you know, they come into the store and they're just so unruly and so obnoxious, and the parents don't get on them. And to me, it would be far better to just openly rebuke the kid, you know, set him straight, than to say, well, I love my kid, because you're not being diligent and disciplining your kid. And like I said, if you read it, better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. I mean, sometimes parents can really have, I think, a convoluted concept when it comes to raising kids. They go, well, if I spank my kid, it means I don't love them. Well, that's foolish. That's stupid. That's the worldly wisdom. That's love concealed. If you know, if you really love your kid, you're going to be firm and quick to discipline. Yeah.
And also, you know, just a peer, a friend of yours that you think to yourself, you see him do something stupid, and you'd say, you know, I don't want to offend this
good
friend of mine.
Yeah.
But, man, you'd be doing them a favor by rebuking
good
them. And at least there's hope. But you conceal it and...
Oh, that's another good example. Yeah, just apply it that way. Yeah, because if you really love the guy, you're going to say, hey, man, take him aside. Say, hey, man.
You have a booger hanger.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, right. And verse 6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. We're dealing with the same thing, right? A friend, he's going to have your best interest at heart. So his wounds are going to be what? They're going to be faithful. They're going to be for your own good. You know, he's going to point out your warts or whatever it is. And it's not meant to offend you. It's really meant to protect you. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Like I said, look at Judas. And look at the flattery that people were trying to try to bring Jesus Christ down on time and time again. But the faithful are wounds of a friend. I think there, in order for that friendship to really be solid, there has to be a situation where there's a trust there, there's a bond there, and then there's a humility there where you can take criticism, where you love somebody deep enough to where you point out their faults and the person loves you enough to where they accept your criticism. And then he says here in that verse 7, it says, a sated man loathes honey, but to a famished man any bitter thing is sweet. There's an old saying that he who feasts every day feasts no day. So what does that mean?
You do something over and over again, it becomes redundant.
Yeah.
It doesn't have its specialness anymore.
Yeah, a sated man loathes honey. In other words, it could be an enjoyable thing to go to a Christmas party or you know, have a Christmas dinner or you know, have a family get together. But if you do it over and over and over and over again, I mean, it can get pretty old quick. But to a famished man, any bitter thing is sweet. Maybe this isn't a good example here, but especially living in this country, I hear people say, and even in my own household sometimes, you know, people say, well, gosh, leftovers, are we going to have that again or whatever? And I think, man, do you have any clue how many people in this world would just love to have those leftovers over and over again, you know? And verse 8 says, like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man who wanders from his home. Like a bird that wanders from her nest. The suggestion to me is this isn't just a chick in a nest. The suggestion is this is the mother that basically leaves her chicklings, you know, to fend for themselves. It's kind of contrary to nature. But apply this spiritually. Tell me how this can be applied spiritually. Like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man who wanders from his home.
Stop going to church.
Good.
Bible study.
Good.
Praying.
Good. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, like I said, you could broaden this application here. You could obviously apply it to fathers who abdicate their responsibility. But you apply this spiritually, I think it says a lot, because the Bible, it says in Hebrews, forsake not gathering with the saints, as is the habit of some. It says in verse 9, oil and perfume make a heart glad, so a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. You know, oil and perfume, they're something that refreshes, they enhance, they intoxicate. And so if you get counsel that is really, really helpful in a person's life, well, you know, it does the same thing to a person. But keep in mind, too, that one of the seven spirits of God is the spirit of counsel. And if anybody ever comes to me for advice, before I even answer them, I'm praying in my heart, the Lord give me the right counsel for this person, because I don't trust my own self. In verse 10, it says, do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. Do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother that's far away. When it says don't forsake your own friend or your father's friend, that suggestion there is that you've developed a relationship here that's been tested and tried and true. Okay, your friend, your father's friend. So in other words, even if you have a blowout, if the friendship has really been tested to be a solid friendship, then do what you can to restore it, rather than find yourself in a situation where, I mean, the day of your trouble, rather than going to your friend who maybe you alienated and didn't reconcile things with, and you want to go to a family member, I mean, he may be far away and he won't be much help to you. So it's just basically saying, hey, man, if you've invested a lot in a friendship, there's going to be things that are going to be tested. And if it continues to grow, then it's worth keeping. It really is, even if you have some disagreements along the way. In verse 11, it says, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may reply to him who reproaches me. Now, what does that mean? Well, what it's saying is this, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may reply to him who reproaches me. The suggestion here is that if you have a son who you know is a really a good kid and you have raised him up, you know, to be a good kid, and you, let's say you've taught him not to lie or not to steal or not to do certain things, and then somebody comes and says, hey, you know what, I think your son was with these guys that stole stuff over there at the drugstore. And you say, well, no, that's not my kid. I guarantee you it's not my kid. And then you end up proving it. That's what it means. He says, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may reply to him who reproaches me. See what I'm saying? In verse 12, it says, a prudent man sees evil and hides himself. The naive proceed and pay the penalty. A prudent man. How many times have we talked about the prudent man? A prudent man is a person who looks at what the consequences are going to be. Because like I've said a number of times going through this book, there's nothing that doesn't have a consequence to it. And a prudent man is always going to ask, what's going to be the consequence of this action? So when it says here, a prudent man sees evil and hides himself, the naive proceed and pay a penalty, the prudent man is always going to look at the situation and say, man, this is going to be a consequence. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. And so he goes the other way. You know, there's an old saying that fools rush in where angels dare not tread. Well, that's a fool for you. Verse 13, it says, take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger and for an adulterous woman who hold him in a pledge. What that suggests to me, take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger. Well, if a person becomes surety for a stranger, that shows this person's got no wisdom, no common sense, no sound judgment whatsoever. And then he says, take his garment. In other words, don't trust this guy because he doesn't show a lot of wisdom at all. And he says, for an adulterous woman, hold him in a pledge. In other words, I think what it's saying there is that if this guy is going to be lending money to strangers, then this guy doesn't show any wisdom, any insight, any common sense, any prudent, any sound judgment. So if you have any transactions with this guy at all, you make darn sure that you've got collateral to back up whatever he says, because this guy doesn't have much brains. And verse 14 says, he who blesses his friend with a loud voice and early in the morning will be reckoned as a curse to him. Well, you know, even Solomon says, there's a time to speak, there's a time to be silent. You know, there's a time to laugh, there's a time to mourn. There's a time and a place for everything, right? And early in the morning, it may not be a good idea to call your friend up at 4 in the morning and say, hey, man, how you doing? I just was thinking of you, and I just wanted to say hi, and how are things going? Hey, what's wrong with you, man? It's 4 o'clock in the morning, man. Show some common sense. You know, you didn't take it as a curse, not a compliment. And verse 15 says, a constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are like, right? How many times have we read something like that? A contentious woman, an argumentative woman, you know, Solomon says it's better to live in a corner of an attic than with a contentious woman. He says a constant dripping of a steady rain. In other words, a contentious woman, she's just a nag, finding fault, finding fault. You ever listen to it, get plugged into a drip, especially if you're trying to sleep? It's got a leaky faucet, drip, 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 and then pretty soon you're wide awake, you're waiting for the next drip. You know, I mean, that's what happens when you get a situation when you got a contentious woman. And verse 16 says, he who would restrain her restrains the wind and grass oil with his right hand. In other words, this type of woman cannot be shut up. They just can't. And I know a couple of women. I know a guy married to a woman like this, and I just feel so bad for him. You know, he won't say anything. The woman just goes on and on and on and on. He just rolls his eyes and he just never says anything because there's no stopping her, no restraining her. And verse 17 is, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. That says a lot too. And especially I think it could be applied to, you know, to God's word. Well, we can really sharpen each other with God's word. Iron sharpens iron. These are ideas where men can discuss things or debate things or talk about things that have some meaning to it. If all people do is sit in front of the TV, watch endless hours of TV, and their mind becomes a bubble gum. You know, they don't sharpen one another. Verse 18 says, he who tends the fig tree will eat his fruit, and he who cares for his master will be honored. The person who serves his master well deserves some recompense. But apply that spiritually. He who cares for his master will be honored. We do Christ's work. In the end, he's going to honor us. But we don't do it for honor. We do it to honor him. And in verse 19, as in water Face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects man. This is good. What is it saying, in essence? Okay, put it this way. How many times have you heard me say, what kind of people do you hang around? The type of friends you have says a great deal about you. It really does. Read this again. As in water, face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects man. In other words, you're going to gravitate to the same kind of people that you are. If you're a liar, a thief, a criminal, a good-for-nothing, that's who you're going to hang around with. That's just it. And if you're a person who is godly, you're going to hang around godly people. The company you keep is going to reflect the type of person you are. And verse 20 says, Sheol and abandon are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied. Sheol is hell, and abandon could be used for death or destruction. All right, even though abandon is the name of a fallen demon in hell. It says, Sheol and abandon are never satisfied. Well, death and hell are never satisfied. It says, nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied. Solomon says something very close to that in Ecclesiastes. He says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. All things are wearisome. And that says a lot, because the old saying, the person says, well, my eyes are bigger than my stomach. Well, we know what that means. It's like, you know, this is a lot more than I... It's almost as though we always want more and we're never going to be satisfied, in a sense, because our eyes are never satisfied. Our ears are never satisfied. And the only thing that's going to make us satisfied in this life is to learn the secret of being content, as Paul says. And if we can be content with what God has given us, that contentment comes through gratefulness, through thankfulness. Yeah.
Where it says in 1 John, all that's in the world, it uses the term lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh and pride of life. And lust is something that can't be satisfied.
Yeah.
So yeah. From the world is right. Satisfaction.
Yeah. Okay, in verse 21 it says, the crucible is for silver, the furnace for gold, and each is tested by the praise accorded to him. And that says a lot, because the crucible is for silver. In other words, you melt silver, you melt gold in a furnace and a crucible. But what really tests a man is the praise that is accorded him. In other words, when you get in a position of high visibility, the more praise you're going to get from people, it can really, really test you, test your character. That's really what tests you. But you take a man like Job. Job was a man who really was impeccable in terms of his character, in spite of the honor that he was given, in spite of his high position, in spite of all his wealth, in spite of all his prosperity, in spite of all his influence and power. All right, that was his real test. That really was his real test, and God knew it. He passed that test with flying colors, so God just figured Job will pass any test, because that was the real crucible. That was the real furnace, was the praise, was the prosperity, was the money, was the fame. And verse 22, though you pound a fool in a mortar with the pestle along with crushed grain, yet his foolishness will not depart from him. You pound a fool in a mortar, in other words, with a pestle, or it's a type of a tool, a club, and you just pound it into like a bowl, or use a big iron sledge to pound down rocks or something like that. You can't separate foolishness from a fool, regardless of how hard you try. And we were talking about that earlier, about, you know, the revolving doors in prison. You just cannot pound it out of them. All right, this bending them. Okay, we'll close these last verses together, because I think 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27 should be read together. It says, know well the condition of your flocks and pay attention to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the grass disappears, new growth is seen, and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in. The lambs will be for your clothing, and the goats will bring the price of a field. And there will be goat's milk enough for your food, for the food of your household, and sustenance for your maidens. Now, like I said, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, they need to be read together. But I think the best interpretation is what I read in the Living Bible, where it basically says this: riches can disappear fast, and the king's crown doesn't stay in a family forever. So watch your business interests closely. Know the state of your flocks and your herds. Then there will be a lamb's wool enough for clothing and goat's milk enough for food for all your household after the hay is harvested and a new crop appears and the mountain grasses are gathered in. I think that's what it says. It's basically, hey man, watch your business interests, but here's the thing too. He's saying know well the condition of your flocks and this type of thing. Apply it to your household. I think that you know, you can make that application as far as the spiritual welfare, well-being of your household. I think that the fathers have a tremendous responsibility in that area to raise up the children in the love and knowledge and fear of God and to know where they are spiritually. It does say an awful lot as far as that application that you can make. You know, it's not just business interests, because what's basically our most important business is the responsibility that God has given us as far as raising up, you know, our households for His glory and for His honor. Anybody have anyone to add or share?